You're listening to The Impromptu on the Hologram Radio Network, a multifaceted show discussing how technology, art, design, and equality converge on topics that matter most to us. From gaming culture to film and other forms of media, we examine the creative process and how the decisions we make shape our perceptions and lives. This is Alex Knight, and I am joined by Michael Norton. Episode 83. iOS 11 might be an Oprah moment. Today on the podcast, it's all about iOS 11. Could it be an Oprah moment? Well, it just may be, because we have some information that's being given to us that says it's very likely this year at Apple's Worldwide Developer Conference that they will finally unleash the new iPad OS. That's right, a version of iOS designed specifically for taking advantage of the larger screen real estate of those tablet devices. And we go into more depth about what's going to happen with iOS 11. So stay tuned for that discussion coming up next on The Impromptu. When everything is broken and nothing's going right.
So, my Bothan spies have informed me something very interesting. None of them died, so don't worry about that. iPad is getting a drastic UX overhaul for iOS 11. Confirmed.
So this is actually happening. This is
actually happening, yes.
It's happening.
So, honestly, this has a long history. So, I know we've talked about it a lot. We were sure it was coming in iOS 10. So the history behind all of this, they were actually working on iPad changes for iOS 10, but it didn't meet the cutoff. And
I want to say we may have touched on that last year at some
point.
Yes, because I remember there weren't rumors like that similar last year saying something was delayed.
It wasn't just rumors. I had heard.
Okay.
Confirmed that they were working on it, and it was supposed to be in iOS 10. And then when it didn't make it to iOS 10, it was supposed to be in a point release like 10.3, but then it didn't come to 10.3 either. So now, apparently, it is actually finally ready and will be in iOS 11.
Fantastic.
When they announce it in June at WWDC in San Jose.
Because I think you would have to be extremely pessimistic to think that Apple has just been twiddling their thumbs, idling away the years without wanting to do anything.
Well, because the thing is, once the iPad Pro was created, it demanded an upgrade to the software. You can't upgrade the hardware to do all of these things and then say, oh, we're going to keep the software the same. It doesn't add up.
Right.
It doesn't match their strategy.
And let's be real, they know this too.
Of course they know this. So the thing with Apple's development of iOS is they come up with a ton of features that they'd like to add. Every team goes, okay, we'd like to do this, we'd like to do this. And the project managers fit it into a schedule for the next major release. So they were working on iPad overhaul, like whatever that entails, we can put it under a single umbrella, iPad overhaul. They were working on that with the goal of shipping it in iOS 10. But because it wasn't ready at the drop dead date for shipment, probably, I don't know, I want to say 2 or 3 months before launch. So probably around WWDC or a month after that, they were like, okay, this isn't going to make it in. So they ripped it out of the builds and they kept working on it in the background. So then it was like, okay, we're going to try again for 10.3. And when they hit that cutoff, no, it's still not ready. So they pushed it back again to iOS 11. Because obviously, if it's not ready, you can't ship it. And you don't want developers to know about it if it's not ready. So the betas have to be scrubbed. You can't have any reference to any of this stuff. So they need time to do all that. So now, literally a year later, so this is a whole year that they've had to work on this of additional time, because it was supposed to be in iOS 10. And they've had an entire year basically to continue improving it, continue adding features, continue redesigning. And we're finally going to get to see what that looks like in June.
And so far, we have no idea what it's going to look
like. We have no idea.
I haven't seen any leaks whatsoever.
I have zero information on what they are doing. I just know that they're doing it. If I had to guess, I would say part of it will involve the home screen, because on a massive 10.9-inch display,
that's the biggest complaint right now that people have.
Yeah, like on a 9.7-inch screen, on supposedly a 10.5-inch screen, on a 12.9-inch screen, the iPad Pros, just a bunch of rows of icons is serving no good purpose.
Yeah. I mean, not only is it boring to look at, it's just not a great use of space, which we've talked about.
Yeah.
I'm very curious about how, I mean, how would you approach it? I mean, forget about speculation, because we could talk about that for hours, but I mean, what would your approach be?
Well, I think if I were going at it, I would say, okay, we've come up with this idea that the iPad Pro can replace your laptop. On the hardware side of things, we have the smart keyboard, we have the Apple Pencil, and iOS works for the iPhone, but it doesn't really work for the iPad. And there's a lot more that we could be doing to take advantage of the hardware and the chips that we have in there. So I would do quite a few things. First of all, I would change iCloud Drive into a real file system. It would be, obviously with APFS, that makes things easier. You can add, it gives you snapshots for free. It gives you history.
And that's a nice callback to a few episodes ago where you just said, Apple, just make it a file system. Just allow us to just put stuff there.
Yeah. So, I mean, even if they don't do it for the iPhone, they should certainly do it for the iPad, because if we're buying into this idea that the iPad can replace your laptop, you need to be able to A, download things, B, open files in different apps.
Yes. Which is, they kind of got sort of there with the document picker.
Yeah, it's sort of there, but they need more work to get it all the way, which I think and hope is part of this. Then, home screen. Absolutely needs to change. Rows of icons serve no purpose on a giant screen. I don't know what to change that to. There are a lot of different options, obviously. There's, it could be an alternate mode that you go into, like Launchpad on macOS.
Right.
They could have a jump list, like in Android, where you tap a button and you get access. Actually, no, that would just be Launchpad, basically.
Yeah, and I don't think Apple would want to do something like that.
Well,
not quite in that exact same
way. Maybe not.
Way.
Then, of course, there's Windows, where you press a button and you get a list that doesn't take up the whole screen. That might be a possible solution. Maybe a bit clunky. I mean, you do still want to show off the art on those app icons. So maybe some kind of hybrid solution. I don't know. But basically, get them out of the way. Maybe have...
You don't think they would take any design elements from the watch with that octagon sort of look?
I feel like the octagon was kind of a misstep, to be honest. It's really difficult to parse. Like, if you have this giant cloud of icons, it's really difficult to pick one specific icon from out of that. And unless you rearrange them into kind of a map that your brain is going to remember, it's difficult to use. So I think that's...
I take that back because obviously that was a restraint of such a small physical display to work with. Whereas the iPad, you have to come at it with a completely different approach because you're working with a much larger screen.
So I think they'll probably do some kind of hybrid approach where it takes the best out of those options and kind of does something new, maybe a popover or something like that.
And take some design, maybe some cues from how Spotlight and Siri already work now with, you know how your most frequently opened apps change all the time?
Yes, exactly.
You know, when you pull down, but have something like that. Maybe you swipe up from the bot, almost like a dock. Take the dock approach, but make it more intelligent. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm thinking. In fact, I'm thinking basically bring the dock from macOS and make that a fundamental part of iPad iOS.
If they completely get rid of the whole grid thing and your apps are basically just hidden until you actually need them, then you have just the wallpaper. It seems like that seems kind of boring though too, right? What would you do with that?
But,
widgets, I guess, like Android?
So then obviously you have that widget panel off to the left, which gives you contextual information. You can have your calendar on there. You can have documents that you were looking at. You can have all kinds of things.
And of course, with an OLED screen on a giant iPad, lots of other opportunities.
We're not quite there yet. OLED isn't going to come to the iPad for at least 2 years, probably. But even with the existing panel, you can do a lot there because with all the app icons gone, you can suddenly add all that contextual information straight onto the desktop, for lack of a better term. And so when you unlock your iPad, you instantly have access to a bunch of information about what's going on in your life. And from there, I think Apple Pencil needs to step up. They need to have a system level API for all of it, where you can annotate things, you can add little notes to everything, you can use essentially an upgraded version of the Apple Watch's scribble mode, where you can write replies and it will translate it to text. That works extremely well, by the way. So
I've heard good things about it. I mean, I don't have an Apple Watch, but I totally believe you.
If that's with just a finger, imagine what they could do using that technology with the pencil. So you could just write and keep writing. And yeah, it would be kind of like what Microsoft's doing with Windows Ink, but I think the iPad absolutely needs it because it makes the device so much more versatile. Instead of typing on the keyboard or typing on the virtual keyboard, you can just scribble things and suddenly a whole essay takes shape from just writing. And I mean, it's kind of a no-brainer because what did we do before we had tablets, right? You would write notes on paper, you would do all of these things. And so it just feels more natural. I mean, a lot of the time, I actually, when I go into a meeting, I take my iPad with me and I write notes in the Notes app. And that works really well. But if they took it a step further, like with OneNote, I could write notes and it would actually transcribe it to text.
Why don't you use the Apple Pencil, though, to write notes?
I do.
Oh, so you,
that's,
okay.
Yeah, that's what
so
I was saying.
So that's what you meant. Okay.
Yeah. So they take that a step further and suddenly everything you write becomes text. You can go into photos. You can like write little notes. That would be accessible to every app.
I like the idea of, well, we already have notification center widgets that have, you know, fairly, you know, use can be useful, but often minimal functionality. But it would be kind of cool if you could, like, if you're in Notification Center and you have widgets there, if you could, like, literally peel the notification off and drag it, and then suddenly when it lands onto the desktop of the iPad, but the functionality would change to accommodate. Okay, now you've got it on your main home screen and it does opens up all this.
Yeah,
other.
You're basically onto my next thing. So
I'm glad we're on the same wavelength.
Yeah, we are. So that's the other big thing I think they should do. Notifications should become objects that you can just kind of move and it opens up a view of that app. Basically taking the split view UI to the next level and going, okay, so we had quick replies, we had split view. Now you get a notification, you can just snap open that app from the notification and it just floats there and you can do whatever you need to do and dismiss it right away.
Wouldn't that be almost like the web OS approach that never really saw the light of day?
Pretty much. That's exactly what I'm thinking. And that approach will actually serve them really well when they move over to the iPhone 8 and they have this giant screen that takes up most of the phone, because if you've got these rounded edges all the way around and you've got rectangular apps, you're going to want to kind of move to a card system where you can bring things up, dismiss them, and it lends itself well to that.
Yeah, if it is that, and if that's what we get, it's interesting because on the one hand, as a consumer, it makes me excited that it opens up all this extra functionality, and maybe the Pro in the iPad Pro would make more sense, that it would maybe be a device that I actually maybe could use more full time. Yeah. And obviously it opens up tons of opportunities for a lot of developers. A concern of mine though is the constant complaints from developers that people aren't buying iPads and they're not buying iPad apps apparently. So would they take advantage of that? That's all remains to be seen. Like, you know, adding those features are great, but will developers trust Apple enough? Because the iPad hasn't really like sort of exploded in the way the iPhone has. It's not a bad seller, but to get the iPad to the point where people want it to be, will developers take that step of spending the time to take advantage of all the APIs, all the functionality of this new OS in order to kind of help Apple propel the iPad into the next generation where now suddenly the iMac is obsolete, your MacBook is obsolete, you know?
Honestly,
I'm sure Apple wants that day where only need tablets.
They do, and I think if Apple builds it, developers will come. That's the thing. For the longest time, iPad has kind of been an afterthought. Up until the iPad Pro hardware, iPad hasn't really changed a whole lot. And apps, even less so. The OS has essentially, for the past 5 years, or when did the first iPad come out?
Oh, God.
2000.
It's been a while now.
Seven, I want to. No.
Oh, no.
2010.
That 2007 is the year the iPhone launched.
Right.
And the iPad did not come for, 2 years after that?
Okay, yeah. It was 2010.
That sounds about right.
7 years. 7 years with iPad.
A lot of models have come out,
and it's still effectively a giant iPhone. In fact, a lot of apps now have moved to a universal UI where on iPad, they mostly look like a blown up iPhone app.
And it's funny because didn't Apple poke fun at Android tablets?
They did.
Press conferences,
they did
show
yeah.
screenshots and our apps aren't like that. Well, yeah,
they are
all,
now.
Not all of them though, but a lot of them are.
Yeah, more now than ever.
It's kind of bad.
So this is basically the crossroads.
#Twitter app.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Twitter had a great iPad app.
Well,
and
before
then,
they bought it from Lauren Brichter and ruined it.
Yeah, but. Up until recently, the iPad app was actually designed for iPad. And then they did this big update and all of a sudden the Twitter app was a universal app. And if you opened it on iPad, it was effectively a blown up version of the iPhone view, which gross. And I mean, that's not to say that approach doesn't work all the time. Like, there are some really good universal apps that have actually taken the time to have a separate interface for iPad. Tweetbot, for example.
Yeah, Tweetbot is really nice. And I think OmniFocus and all those guys the Omni suite of apps, they've been first class iPad apps all the way.
Yeah. So, I mean, great apps for iPad are out there, but the problem is a lot of the apps that people want to build aren't possible with the current platform.
Well, and then there's the whole pricing model. Now, keep in mind, like apps like the Omni suite of apps, those are few and far between.
Yeah.
And they're charging a premium productivity. I mean, their brand is considered a premium priced product, like lots of functionality for professionals. They're not afraid to charge $45, $50 for an app, $60 for an app on the iPad, which is an anomaly.
Yeah.
And
they get it.
A lot of
too.
Other develop. Yeah, they get it. But a lot of other developers that want to see success on the iPad are frustrated because, you know, people don't want to spend. People, you know, complain about $5, say even $6 on an app, and when they're spending, you know, effectively $100,000-$200,000 worth of development time to release an app that they can only sell realistically for 99 cents, $1.99, $2.99 max, $3 getting expensive. I mean, it's crazy when you think about $3. Yeah. You're complaining about $3. Come on. But it happens. That's the landscape.
It is now. But I think the thing is, once Apple gets on that stage and says, iPad is changing, iPad is now a professional product, and it will allow you to get things done. Once they make that shift, once they announce those new features and new APIs and say, and even get a few select developers on stage and say, look at what these developers have been able to do with the new iPad UI. For example, imagine if Adobe got on stage and said, here's
that would be a
Photoshop
big deal. Yeah.
For iPad.
And not just Photoshop elements. Like,
no, not just elements, actual Photoshop. Layers, tools, everything. Artboards.
Integrated with the Creative Cloud syncing.
Yeah.
That would be incredible.
Yeah.
The collaboration.
Save your PSD and iCloud
on all
drive.
Devices?
Open it on everything.
Oh my god, that would blow people's minds.
And then, if not them, imagine if they got the guys who make Sketch up on stage.
Yeah, yeah. Now we're talking.
Sketch for iPad, $79.99. Full functionality. Everything you get on Sketch for Mac, you get on iPad with that beautiful panel, with Apple Pencil support for the pen tool, with.
It's an Oprah moment.
Yeah. And once that happens, iPad suddenly isn't a giant iPhone anymore. It's a mini MacBook Pro that you can actually do things on.
Hello, this is Alex Knight from Hologram Radio, here to tell you about a fun new podcast that we recently launched called Serial Sommelier. Each week, David Kahlo and a guest select a random episode of a much beloved 1970s and 1980s Saturday morning cartoon series, review the episode, have some laughs, and of course, pair the perfect sugar cereal with it. Subscribe to Serial Sommelier today in iTunes, TuneIn, Stitcher, Google Play Music, and of course, wherever you can find your favorite podcasts. But don't they need to do more than just give us APIs to unlock advanced functionality to take advantage of the screen real estate? I mean, don't they need other things to, like, I feel like there needs to be more for professionals to really adopt. Yes, of course, the creative suite, those big, you know, top tier apps need to be in terms of like feature parity as close as humanly possible. So you could more or less get the work done, or at least pick up where you left off. You started on a desktop workstation. You could at least finish it maybe on an iPad. That would be a big, big deal. But don't they need to do other things like continue to work on the Apple Pencil? What about other methods?
Oh, of course.
But what about other methods of input? Like, what I heard rumors they were going to do some, God, what was that thing that, I mean, people, or maybe it was just a pipe dream people wanted.
So this is the thing. A lot of that stuff is already there thanks to the smart connector. All they have to do is release new smart connector accessories for the iPad Pro, and they can extend the hardware functionality of the device. Right now there's just a keyboard, but they could attach anything to that connector if they wanted to. One example they gave was a keyboard for music production.
Right. Yes. Yeah, that's a big deal.
At the very first keynote when they announced the smart keyboard, they showed a slide where they had a keyboard attached to the smart connector. That product never actually got created, but imagine if it did. Imagine if they then created an entire lineup of peripherals.
I mean, we're far from the days of getting all of this equipment that I have here in front of me, like, in, you know, somehow make that doable, but on a mobile device, that's not going to happen. But you can, you, today, 2017, you can record audio into an iPad with a decent lightning microphone. They do exist.
So imagine if they created a peripheral for the smart connector where you just clip this thing on and suddenly it's a full production studio.
Yeah.
I mean, okay, maybe not full, but
not even Apple's own Logic Pro is on iPad, and people want the ability to, for podcasts, for example, like I want the ability not just record my voice, I want a professional audio app that can also do, like, I want to be able to do multi-channel audio on an iPad. I want to be able to, like, what about bringing in, what about getting audio from a third-party app into and record that, like, from Skype. I want to be able to record a Skype call on an iPad with my own voice, mix that down, all from an iPad. There has got to be a way to accomplish this.
Well, in the near term, that particular use case may not happen.
The processing power is there.
Oh, it's absolutely there.
I mean, it may not be at the top of their own priority list.
Yeah.
But we got to get there, I'm sure.
It's not implausible for them to add something like that in the future. I don't think that'll happen day one, but I think we'll get there because they kind of, like, the name of the game is essentially replacing everything that the MacBook does.
Yes, that's right.
I think they're finally doing that now. I think hopefully they're firing on all cylinders, being like, okay, yeah, let's cannibalize the Mac. Let's do it. And this is step one, basically. And the other big thing, Apple Pencil. So I talked about software improvements that they could make to make Apple Pencil better, but there's also hardware tweaks they can do. They can put a W1 chip in a new Apple Pencil that would let it run for, I don't know, a week, maybe.
Yeah, because honestly, how much battery power is that the pencil going to take, right? I mean,
right.
A lot.
They can create different tips for art apps. They can give it an eraser, maybe a button.
I want to say, like, a few weeks ago, I saw people talking about why doesn't Apple make, or maybe it might have been a rumor, and maybe you can speak to this, but they were talking about why doesn't Apple let you use the iPad as, like, a Cintiq almost with your Mac? Like that kind of integration? That would be awesome.
That I actually have heard about. Okay. So supposedly they are working on the ability to plug an iPad Pro into a Mac and it would work as a Cintiq.
Yeah. Yeah. That I would love to live to see that day. I mean, not that I have a particular use for, but someone like you, I mean, so many people would jump on that.
But it will require the new iPad Pro hardware coming out in the fall because they're going to upgrade the Lightning ports to use USB 3.1.
Yeah.
Which will allow it to have the bandwidth to actually have that.
And
connection.
I would imagine I mean, as good as the Apple Pencil is now too, probably need even further, what's the word? Not resolution, but,
latency.
Yeah. The latency when you're actually drawing. I mean, it is quite good. I don't know how it compares to a Cintiq now. I don't know if, I mean, Wacom is, someone said apparently Wacom devices are not as good as the Apple Pencil
in
terms of the ability to track
The latency on the pencil is essentially 1-to-1.
I do see there. I do see the delay. I did try it out. I can see it.
Yeah, but it's slight.
It's really. I mean, it is. It's gotten to the point now where it's quite usable. It's very good. And so, like, I was shocked, honestly. Like, this is the first revision, and this is how accurate it is out of the gate. Like, can you imagine, like, one or two more revisions, how freaking amazing this is going to be?
Oh yeah.
So I'm sure whatever they come out with, if they do this year with a new Apple Pencil, it's going to be awesome.
Yeah. And so, I mean, all of this put together, like I said, it's step one in allowing the iPad to become as good as a Mac. And I'm really excited to see what they actually have for us. Especially if they can get developers on stage with full apps. Plus, I think the atom bomb of iPad apps will be announced. Xcode for iPad.
Yes, which of course people have been talking about for years. Will they or won't they?
And they will.
So how would that work, though? Would they allow you to import? I guess they would. They should if they.
Well,
no,
from
iCloud, import an existing Xcode session.
Yeah,
will it have the processing power to be able to handle a big session? I don't know.
Well, I mean, the thing is, you've got the full Swift compiler and all of that stuff in iOS, anyways.
Yeah. If you go to compile and the app knows it's going to take like an hour to compile it, they might want to tell you to plug into a power source.
Yeah, I could see that.
I mean, for something so intense like that, they but that's fine. Those are for professionals.
And obviously this app would be iPad Pro only. There's no way it would run on previous iPads.
I don't think many people will care about that because I guarantee you people will go out and buy an iPad for that. Guarantee it.
My other guess is that it will probably work best on the new hardware. So they may not actually announce it at WWDC. If they do, it'll probably be in beta. And the idea is that it'll come out with iOS 11 in the fall when they announce the new iPads. So then you'll get this shiny new hardware on an A10X or A11X chip, which at that point, it's basically going to be desktop grade performance. The A10 is already pushing it. The A10 is already faster than a lot of Mac laptops.
Yeah, because we've seen those test results where they compare it and it's... It is, you're right, it is at the point now where it's very impressive, and that gap is getting so close now.
Yeah, and more importantly, iOS 11 is going to ditch 32-bit. So with that chunk of processing freed up, it's possible that they'd be able to do other things with the chip.
Do you want to maybe tell some of the developers that... that make some of the apps that are on my phone to maybe update their apps, because I already got multiple warnings after upgrading to, of course, as you know, I'm on the public betas and I might have to hold off of upgrading to iOS 11 for a while because there's a couple of useful apps that, first of all, I'm only using because they are more of a utility. And those apps haven't been updated in 3 years. So like the likelihood of the developer updating them is probably slim.
Yeah, I wouldn't hold out too much hope. Yeah,
I might have to just bite the bullet at some point, just upgrade. Because
probably
if they haven't upgraded it in 3 years, what are the
chances?
They're
not going to, I mean, updated.
I mean, they might come out with a new version, right? And that's sold separately as a new app. And I'd be fine with that. So iOS 11, 64-bit only, right?
Yes.
And it's not only, I just want to make sure I have this right. If you have 32-bit apps on the phone already and you upgrade, those apps will completely stop working.
I believe so, yes.
Because I think, because I remember the whole point of the warnings in iOS 10.3 was to basically, this is just like the transition period to let you know when we get to iOS 11, you're going to be stuck.
Yeah, that's what I've been hearing. That's what people have been saying that they've been hearing as well. iOS 11 will completely eliminate 32-bit.
Actual improvement, the actual real-world benefit that we get? Because in the desktop world, I do remember the very obvious reason why you would want 64-bit was because of the addressable memory accessible. Now, obviously, our iPhones don't have 32 gigs, 64, and 128 gigabytes of RAM. So why do we need 64-bit?
So iOS is capable of addressing all that memory, of course. But more fundamentally, the thing with 32 versus 64 is desktop operating systems have both, which means they have 32 and 64-bit runtimes for applications. So there's a chunk of software and embedded hardware on the chip that are allowing both types of applications to run. If you eliminate 32-bit, which nobody up until this point has done yet, Apple would be the first. By eliminating the 32-bit runtime and possibly by redesigning their chips to take advantage of that space, they could create more efficient chips, much faster software.
Okay.
They would basically be able to completely optimize for 64-bit, which would allow them to fit more performance onto the same chip. It's unclear whether iOS 11 would actually improve performance on an existing device in that way,
right?
Because it may require an actual hardware change. But at the very least, the software will probably run a little better because it doesn't have to have that 32-bit runtime in the background.
Okay. That makes more sense. Thank you for explaining that.
So even like, I think the other thing with the memory is because iOS uses randomized memory addresses for everything, that's part of its security. It randomizes the location of everything so that it's really difficult for people to find things like root access and where things are in the system at any given time. Because it randomizes that, 64-bit adds to that security because suddenly you have exponentially more memory addresses to put things. So that randomization gains like whatever to the 10th power. Yeah, so
there's a very important security reason why you want to do that.
And if they ever wanted to make a Mac that runs iOS.
Here we go.
Or if they ever wanted to make a laptop that has an A series chip in it running iOS
sooner or later.
Yeah. They could add that amount of RAM and it would be addressable by the system. And it also gets the 2038 problem out of the way. So that's a whole other topic. I think I've mentioned it before, but basically in 2038, if you don't have a 64-bit processor, you're doomed. And this is a big problem for embedded systems that haven't been updated in decades.
Good luck with that.
Yeah, hopefully they manage to upgrade everything before then.
No, there will be some disasters, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah, it's possible.
It's already happening now, I think.
Yeah, we've already started seeing some early signs because things like things that are, if you set it to 2038 for whatever reason, it goes crazy.
Mm.
Basically, it's the fact that a particular date in 2038 in the Unix epoch, the number of digits in that time code is higher than 32-bit is capable of addressing.
Okay.
Which means it creates a buffer overflow in a 32-bit processor.
Oh, everyone loves buffer overflows.
Yeah. So because it's a hardware problem, any 32-bit processor will effectively crash on that date and time. Meaning all processors must be upgraded to 64-bit by that time.
But, I mean, this is mostly not going to be an issue on the consumer space or even the enterprise space, because we've had 64-bit CPUs for a long, long time.
Yeah. I mean, the only problem at this point but is like those saying, embedded those systems.
Yes, right.
So, I mean, things like really old cash registers, missile silos, that kind of thing. Those all have to be upgraded to modern
processors.
But
the mission-critical ones, I'm sure, I mean, especially something that is dangerous.
You would hope so.
That they would, I mean, I'm sure they're on that. They have to be working on that.
Oh, I'm sure.
And I imagine for the embedded systems, I guess the other challenge is proprietary software, having to recode things, because it's not just, oh, let's just swap CPUs.
Well, yeah, like
you're
that's
doing
the,
whole system upgrades.
I was actually reading an article about people that still know how to program in COBOL, which is one of the earliest programming languages.
I can't even remember
the
last time I met somebody that knew COBOL.
So there's this company, they call themselves the COBOL Cowboys, and they basically are contractors, and they go around fixing COBOL systems that are still in operation at bank companies and other places of that
nature. When you say still in operation, you mean still running? I mean, they fix them while they're running? Or you don't mean that literally? Like, they're going to these companies that have these old systems, and they're just doing these software upgrades. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, they're fixing bugs and things like that, because they're the only ones who know.
Nobody
how.
Else knows. Well, it's like assembly too,
right?
Like, who else knows machine code effectively? Like, come on now. I mean, Steve Gibson is the only guy that I know that still makes apps like that because of the small advantages. Yeah. Although I believe mission critical apps that absolutely need to run reliably are, I think, the stuff that's on the space shuttle, where you cannot mess around with stuff like that.
No,
it needs to be nimble, small. It can't have the overhead of high level C languages. I mean, it has to be examined and inspected and done closely.
Yeah, a lot of that stuff is still worked on at NASA for sure. Plus, I mean, it helps that a lot of their circuitry is like 10 years old because they have to radiation harden it for space.
Yes, right, right.
So it's like the current fastest processor they have is something like a Pentium 2, I think. So there's that. But as for these COBOL guys, it's like bank companies still have...
It's a scary thought, isn't it?
...stuff I mean, running on one of the oldest programming languages. Yeah.
And it's not just take yourself out of the equation. We're talking about people that basically run the economy.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what are we as a society without currency?
Right.
I mean, just imagine the kind of chaos you would have.
Yeah.
Of like, every banking system just was taken offline.
The story does also mention that they are working on upgrading to more modern languages.
Oh, so they're upgrading from Windows 3.1? Or OS
Windows 3.1.
I'm not even joking. I've seen terminals where they go down and like you're running Windows 95 or Windows XP even. Yeah. Like what is going on here?
It's crazy. But yeah, back to the iPad and 64-bit. It's like the 2038 thing. Sure, it's a problem, but that ultimately doesn't matter to this decision. Really, it's just moving into the future, making sure that things are forward-looking, future-proof, and hopefully being able to optimize and make it more efficient and performant along the way. So if you're getting that warning on some of your apps, be prepared to say goodbye to them. Their time has come.
You've been listening to the Impromptu One Hologram Radio. I'm Alex Knight, joined by Michael Norton, as always. If you'd like to show your support for this podcast and the work that we do here, the single best way to do that is to go to patreon.com/hologramradio and donate today. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes to ensure you get every new episode each and every week. And do leave us a review if you have a moment that makes us feel good, as well as helps other people find the podcast. We're also available in Google Play Music, TuneIn, and Stitcher as well if you'd like to stream it there, and wherever else you can find podcasts. You can follow us on Twitter. We're at The Impromptu. Michael Norton is at Zen Impulse. I'm at Zero Distraction. And if you'd like to send us feedback the old-fashioned way, you can email us at theimpromptu@hologramradio.org, and that will go to both myself and Michael.
And on that note, thanks for listening, everyone. See you next time.